Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Friday Special, a podcast by Guitar Nerds. Now for 2020, the Friday Special series is running every week, and each week I have a new guest from the world of guitars, amplification and effects pedals. We're going to have brands and producers, musicians and luthiers. I'm your host, Joe Branton, joined by our special guest, luthier and founder of Scatterbrain Concepts, or SBC Guitars, Stuart Robson. Hello, Stuart, and welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, man. Thank you so much for having me on your show, first of all.
You are absolutely welcome.
It's like I said before, I've been listening to these Friday specials and really enjoying them. And there's been a bit of me that's been really hoping that you would invite me on to chat, because it's always a pleasure to chat with you anyway, from when we've chatted at shows and such. So yeah. Very excited to be here.
Oh, thank you very much. No, it is great to have you on the show, because there's such an interesting story behind the brand as well. And yes, absolutely, with the Friday specials, I'm kind of trying to get round to everyone I know in the industry, which is, you know, which from the amount of time I've been doing it is so many people. And every now and again, I'll just be sort of, you know, I don't know, like sitting around or lying in bed or something, and I'll be like, oh, I need to ask them. So thank you very much for coming on the show. I believe this episode's going out the week after our Friday special with Katie Tunstall as well. So quite a different one, moving from sort of popularized looper artist into kind of ergonomic super luthier. quite a change. But for listeners, if you're not familiar with SBC and all the wonderful things that they're doing. SBC or Scatterbrain Concepts. Which one do you prefer? Is it supposed to be SBC and it's just that it means Scatterbrain Concepts?
Yeah, I changed it a couple of years ago from Scatterbrain Concepts. Basically, when it started making money, I stopped being Scatterbrain Concepts.
Right, I see.
Because I just thought SBC sounded a little bit more professional.
It's a bit more concise. I mean, I love Scatterbrain Concepts. I think that's a great name. But definitely SBC is slightly more concise and obviously fits a little better on the headstock as well.
Yeah, there is that, yeah.
But yes, for listeners who aren't familiar with SBC, SBC Guitars are a custom shop guitar company who focus, your focus is to challenge the core concepts behind guitar building, you know, such as the reliance on particular woods, conventions of shape, and really a design focus on mass manufacture rather than playability. So Stuart builds ergonomic, artistically sculpted, often wood-focused instruments that all have an attention to detail that I don't think you see in many other places in electrical or electric guitar luthery. There you go. There's my overview for the listener. Is that appropriate?
Yeah, I'd say that's a fairly fair summary. I think it's the way that it's shifted in the past couple of years, and it has been quite meteoric, really, the rate at which things have shifted sometimes, I feel. And this is because I can't help but just get something into my brain and I just have to keep sort of pulling it until it goes as far as it can go, or I run out of things to pull, you know?
Right.
And it's... So the way that it's shifted a little bit is I've shifted more towards it being, I guess, more ergonomically minded than fully ergonomic instruments.
Right, I see.
And it's trying to get this perfect balance between, well, balance for one thing, of the actual instrument. You've got the playability, which all comes down to the ergonomics, the access, which is why we always do, I always try and make the access up the neck very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And just the it's a little bit hard to, but almost the sort of muse nature of it, the way that you want to look at an instrument and you want to be inspired by it and you want to pick it up and you want to play it and you want to, you know, you want it to have a song in it.
Right, right.
Is what I really want. So even though they are, I know my instruments are not cheap, but I want them to be instruments that people feel inspired and they write fantastic music on.
I see. That's, you know, that's a fantastic kind of theory to have, I guess, backing up the, before you even start building, to just have that as the thing that you focus on to get started on everything. I mean, the guitars do have a very, very unique look to them. Listener, if you're not familiar, I thoroughly recommend, you know, obviously visit sbcguitars.co.uk to check them out, because I don't know if I'd really correctly be able to explain them, because the body shapes don't really lean on any conventions that have come before, not for traditional guitars or even really for modern guitars. And I would say when it comes to things like, it's like you've made guitars from scratch again, without any influence coming through or any restrictions. So I think that applies to things like size as well, because often your guitars are quite small, like very small, lightweight.
That was something we were very keen on early on, and we've moved away from the trying to keep them so small now, but we still try and keep them fit very comfortable. They're almost like they should fit almost like they should pocket into you or something.
I see.
Regardless of how you want to play them. So I've always tried to design the ergonomic of what a customer wants to achieve first, and then we design the aesthetic around it.
I see. So you design instruments obviously from the absolute blank piece of paper scratch for custom builds for people, but you do have a sort of a set number of body shapes that you also offer as kind of a starter jumping off point.
Yeah, how it tends to go when people order with me is it's usually they've seen something that they like on my Instagram feed or whatever. But because of the nature of what I can offer, and because of the nature of, I think, people having, you know, full control to suggest what they want, and, you know, and it's a very interactive process because I want to design the right instrument for someone, and I want them almost to take the lead to an extent with what they want. And I'll suggest things around the ergonomics and the comfort and the aesthetic of it overall. But it's very customer led. So most of the commissions that I've got on at the moment, they're not purely my design. They're sort of almost designed with the customer, and they're variants on our Cygnus build. We've got, you know, or they're variants on our Vega builds, but with their own tweakings. And it won't generally be anything with the ergonomics, because I tend to find people leave that side of it alone. It'll be, you know, a little bit of an aesthetic tweak and just a little bit of personalization to them. And I think that's a lovely thing to be able to offer as well, because you're building a completely unique instrument for someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we'll come onto that a little bit with the basses later, and probably the Falcon bass that you recently designed. Because I think that's a great example of an instrument that seems to have been something that was very much a collaborative build. But I think before we go into that, I kind of want to talk about sort of where it started, the first models that you introduced, and I guess how you feel the range has progressed as you've introduced different models. But almost before I even go into that, as we've spoken about, you know, things like the ergonomics, you know, the body size, all of these things that you're considering, it even comes down to the type of woods that you use. Where you are not limited by, you know, what is expected of a guitar. You're very interesting and very artistic when it comes to the woods, because of course you use a lot of things like Purple Heart in there for it, with an incredible skill, you know, used as individual, like, as lines running through the guitar rather than, you know, anything more. There's seems to be a lot that goes into the wood selection on your guitars.
Yeah, for sure. It's I'm not super traditional with like tone woods and things like that, and I'm not traditionally trained. Like, I was never taught to build. I learned to build from growing up in a house where there was no one that built anything, but I inherited a load of my granddad's tools, and he was a carpenter. And unfortunately, I never got to meet him, but we had loads of his tools and an old workbench, and I was just fascinated by them. So I would play with them. And, you know, that's how I know how to build things.
I see.
And how I, and, you know, getting into it, I was just, I do use traditional materials. I use quite a bit of swamp ash and things like that. But I don't feel that tied into the whole tone woods thing. So I try and be a little bit more liberal with it. And part of that is also that, so around London, we have some fantastic trees that are constantly being taken down because people want to build horrible flat blocks everywhere. And these trees are beautiful, historic things. And if I can turn them into an instrument that someone's going to love and cherish for the rest of their life, like there's a lovely little feeling of a story in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Big fan of that. The idea of using kind of reclaimed or wood with a story for a guitar, that's a great way to make a unique and interesting instrument.
I think it is. I mean, I use a lot of reclaimed wood, and I use a lot of stuff that's sort of been saved from the chipper. And mostly what I'll look at when I'm looking at woods is more about like the densities and the weights and how straight the grain is. I'm not so fussed about what the actual breed of it is. Generally, I try to avoid anything that's been shipped for miles and is on the, you know, on the cusp of being CITES listed, or because I you know, it's problematic for the future. But also, we have some fantastic woods on our doorstep that we can use. Uh-huh. And that's all it comes down to. And that's, you know, literally, there's loads of wood that is being pulled out of houses that you can use. There's that whole build, the reclaimed wood build that I did for the Holy Grail is mostly house building material, and that's right. Like some beautiful old 1970s mahogany, some Brazilian mahogany from the Victorian days, so couldn't ship it anywhere, unfortunately. Yeah. But it's completely, you know, fairly ethically sourced, and some old pine roof rafters for the top, because I couldn't get hold of spruce.
Amazing. We should talk in more detail about that, actually, about the, because you were asked to build a guitar for this year's, it was this year's Holy Grail, the last one.
Yeah, so we would have been exhibiting in it, and I think technically we are listed as exhibitors because mm-hmm. we got into it. It was always a dream of mine and Hobbs. So Hobbs builds with me a couple of days a week, and but he's very instrumental in helping me out with like a lot of the jigs and a lot of the machining and a lot of the things that have made some of the crazy weird stuff we do possible, really. So we'd always said when we started building together, we went to Holy Grail to visit a couple of times, and we always said it was our goal to get into Holy Grail and to exhibit there. And then when they announced that this year was going to be the last year, we were like, we're not going to get in. It's, you know, it's fine. It's cool. We've learned a lot from going and visiting. And then to get into the show, and then for all this to kick off and for it to not end up happening,
yeah,
was just a... It was funny, to be honest.
It was so close.
Yeah. But, you know, we still had a great time over that weekend. We, you know, we both got involved in a lot of the things that they did, because they put it all on Facebook. There was various chats and meetups. And, you know, I've ended up becoming a bit friendly with a few of the other builders that would have been there. You know, we chatted with Jamie Swannell and Rosie from Turnstone, and then we've been able to chat with Jacko from Ricker's Guitars and get to know some of the organisers all through doing all this stuff online, and that's been amazing. I got a very brief chat with Michael Spolt as well on through Zoom, which was quite cool, and got to quiz him about some of his designs, which was amazing. Because I'll fully admit, like, I love his designs, but I don't understand the half of them. And getting that little glimpse behind the curtains was amazing, and just opened me up to a whole new world of possibilities that I'm sure I shall run in at some point.
yeah, fantastic. But that Holy Grail guitar you built, obviously a reclaimed wood instrument, was incredible. I mean, it was a fantastic work of art, like even for you sort of thing. I think it was, it had some incredibly interesting design features that seemed to not necessarily move away from the ergonomic backbone of your guitar builds, but seemed more artistically driven than anything else.
Yeah, it's I love that build, and it's one of the guitars that I go to, and I've actually had offers on it, and I've kind of refused them because I don't really want to let it go. I'm not ready to let it go yet. But I think what I love about that instrument, it's almost like doing a custom order. In that you've got restrictions on it. You've got limitations on what you can do, and you've got, you know, you've got to use certain materials, and, you know, getting hold of bits of wood big enough to make a guitar body out of as a reclaimed. I get loads of reclaimed wood, but most of it I use for necks. So I had to become really resourceful, and I managed to, I was hunting around in my parents' loft, and I found these bits of old countertop that I was told was a Victorian countertop that Grandad had pulled out of a place that he'd pulled down. And I was like, oh, that's, have you got plans for this? No? Cool. I'm having this. And just disappeared off with it. And I'd gone, like, I'd been sort of trudging around, you know, various skips and furniture yards and things like that, and just trying to find the right bit, you know, a table with a thick enough top or something like that.
That's incredible. What? You didn't think of that as being the method to finding reclaimed wood. That's incredible.
Yeah, well, but I couldn't find it, unfortunately. It wasn't until just purely by chance, I think I was helping my dad out with something, and I stumbled across these three bits of Brazilian mahogany, and I've still got enough for a couple of tops or something similar to the Cygnus. Right. But it was thin, so it restricted you. And I had this idea in my head of making this semi-hollow instrument, because it's, I love semi-hollow instruments, and I don't get to build them very much, because a lot of what I build is for the, like, more high output, high gain, sort of genty prog metal stuff. Yeah. And actually, I really like building semi-hollows. They're a lot of fun to build, and I love just sitting and twanging away on one. And so I had to be a bit clever, and I sort of layered up a couple of these panels to make the body out of. Didn't have a, normally I will always do a through neck, but I didn't have that option with this one. So I did a set neck. Right. And then because it was quite small, and we were thinking about how we could, A, where we could get some spruce from to do the top. So it had like an acoustic response. And B, how we could then amplify that. So we ended up getting, I ended up finding this place that had all these Victorian joists in the ceiling, ceiling joists. So I bought a load of them. I bought about 16 foot of them.
Right.
So that I could search through them, plane them up on one side each, and just search through them and find the perfect bit of wood to make the top out of. And I confess I didn't really find the perfect bit of wood. I ended up using three pieces that were the least knotty.
Right.
just to try and get that sort of quarter sawn spruce look to it. And then we had a solid center block, and we thought, well, we can amplify the volume a little bit if we put some little reeds in the instrument. So I made these very fine reeds. They're completely unremovable, that are just in the body of the instrument, that when you strum it, you get just much more volume out of it than you would do if they weren't in there. So although it's quite a small instrument, we were able to like pack that extra bit of punch in it. And then we can have a bit of fun with where we did the sound holes. So the sound holes are sort of architecturally built into the edges of the top.
Yeah. And yeah, so it very much looks like the top of the guitar is coming away on one side.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is something that I suspect I'd probably seen somebody else do it and thought that looks cool. But, I put it all together in this one thing, and it's a multi-scale, because that's kind of what I do now.
You're definitely moving more. A lot of the stuff seems to be multi-scale these days. I think when I borrowed a handful of guitars from you, the one I liked the most was the one that wasn't multi-scale, but I think that was because I'm not very used to multi-scale. So,
that 24-inch guitar, I've still got that, and it pains me that I still have that.
It's so good. It's so good, because it was neck like a baseball bat, through neck, quite deep, like very deep in comparison to the other guitars that you make. It's probably only as thick as a Telecaster, but felt deep when you were playing other SBC guitars alongside it. Small body, really interesting hole idea because they're literally just the circular sort of patterned holes of different shapes.
A
great guitar. I what I loved about that guitar was the fact that it had a huge neck for something that was so small and lightweight, and I don't expect that from modern luthiers. I expect everything to be very skinny and very flat.
I like a chunky neck myself. I grew up playing Ibanezes. I don't know how I ended up making guitars with quite chunky necks by comparison, but I've always found when I play, I still got my Ibanezes because I love them, but I don't really play them. And when I do, my hand feels so sore afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
And this is why what we tend to do is these asymmetric necks, which I think you probably did try one of the early asymmetric neck ones, but
I did. Yeah, I absolutely did. The
The SB3, the original. The SB3. Yeah. So we, similar sort of thing. So we do them a bit chunkier at the top and thinner at the bottom, so you get the feel of it being a thin neck and not having any material sort of too much under your thumb, but you've still got a nice anchor for the back of your thumb,
right,
or you can wrap it over quite nicely and go sort of bluesy style, and you still get a very versatile instrument.
Yeah, it was definitely incredibly comfortable. The idea of the asymmetric neck, I think, works very well from a comfort perspective.
Yeah, I like it. We offer all sorts. I will make however people want me to make their necks. But that I find works really well, and it's one of those things that you have a few on guitars at shows and people are like, oh this neck, what's going on there? And then they sit and play it for a bit, and then it sort of, hopefully it slowly breaks them and they end up having to order.
Well, it is, they certainly don't feel like I expect them to. I expect a certain thing from modern guitars, and I think this is very different. It has, everything has very much its own feel. But coming back to the Holy Grail guitar, because there's still so much to it. I love how the scratch plate is mounted on top of the area of the top that raises away to reveal the sound holes at the end of the body. So you get this kind of this layered lower bout to the guitar. I mean, listener, it's impossible for me to describe that. And then you have the controls and everything mounted into the top layer of that.
Yeah, that was meant to fly. That was almost meant to be like a piece that was peeling up, and I could never figure out how to get that right. And then with it being so thin and with it having those reeds in it, and I also wanted to put a push-pull in it, I ended up putting that sort of stepped bit into it so that I just had enough room to get the electronics in neatly. So that was a bit of an afterthought, the stepped bit. But actually, a lot of people said they really liked that, and it just added a nice break in it.
Yeah, exactly how you said, like curving up. It's like pages in a book on that side. It's a really good, like, as a sort of from an aesthetic perspective, it's a really nice feature on that guitar.
Thank you.
Oh, not at all. One of the other things I think on this guitar, which is something that you've brought in a lot of your other guitars, is that obviously they're so wood focused. There isn't a lot of metal on a lot of your instruments, and you sometimes make your own bridges, design your own bridge construction, which again is not what I'd expect from a modern instrument, because what you do is make them simple, whereas I think a lot of modern bridges are all about being able to micro adjust things for, you know, intonation purposes. But you'll make almost traditional floating style bridges. Even on the on the Holy Grail one, even more interestingly, is you've sort of done it as a half through body construction, because they string through the top, but not the or part of the top. It's almost cut away from the top and part of the body underneath, and you've got this like copper piping that runs up for the strings to run through.
Yeah, so the copper piping, there's no function to that other than I just wanted to put a little bit more metal into it visually.
I see.
It doesn't, you can remove it and it has no difference to the sound whatsoever, really. It's just there for, it does make it a little bit easier to string it. But otherwise I just kind of put that in there aesthetically, because I just liked the look of this slightly, I hate to say it, but this slightly steampunky copper piping coming out of the wood. And also with the inlay on the fretboard, that's the same copper piping that we used for some of the various sort of star points on the inlay. So it kind of just tied it together quite nicely. But yeah, like different things like that sort of partially through body anchor was something we've been experimenting with for a while. And something that I found really interesting with doing that was that I like the bone saddle thing on a electric instrument, because it's not like there's no more, I couldn't hear any more or less sustain versus a conventional sort of metal bridge. Uh-huh. What I do think it has is it has a really nice warm bass response. And what I did find, which was really interesting, was with changing the material that anchored the strings, actually changed the sound quite a bit. And I didn't really expect that, because in my head, all of the sound pretty much comes between the start of the nut or the fretted string,
right,
and the saddle. You don't really think of sound coming from behind the nut or behind the saddle, or even to the anchor. And to have that, the different material change that. So originally we did steel and we swapped it out for brass, and it just warmed it all up quite a bit, surprisingly. Oh. So although it's a bit of bone at the end, and then it's a nut. Then it's a brass anchor, and then it goes through the body, and then it goes over the saddle. So there's quite a lot going on there, even though it looks simple.
Yeah, I guess there's quite a lot of contact as well, which is going to help.
Yeah, and then the bridge itself is just positioned. So that is, we'd done them in the past where we'd done them where they were screwed on. We'd position them and then we'd screw them on. But I wanted to leave that one loose just in case, for minor intonation adjustments. But I've found the intonation on that really well. But that the intonation is set by me,
right,
in a very long-winded way of me sitting there with a file, tuning it up, going, nah, that's not quite right, and just doing micro adjustments to the angle to get it right on the actual bone.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of attention to detail.
It's a lot of work for a little bit more bass response. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, I guess it is. The back of the guitar, I think, is almost the most surprising thing with this instrument as well, because whilst it's flat on the top, it's not on the back.
No. No, it's got a, I don't know if there's a name for the style of carve. Again, I'm not so traditionally minded, so I don't know, or trained, so I don't know if they have a name, but it's got a very, there's almost no carve to the top. There actually is a very subtle one, but it looks like there's almost no carve to the sort of the top of the back, as it were. And then it drops off quite steeply by about an inch, by about a centimetre, about 1.2, I think it is. And then it sort of flattens out at the edge. And it was just, again, to get, I wanted to get that feeling of the slim finish to it. And overall, I think the guitar, I'd meant to grab it before I came in to my front room. It comes out at about 38 mil, right, the body.
Wow. Okay.
So there's not much in it at all, but I wanted it to feel like it was like, you know, almost, there was almost nothing to it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The edges, so yeah, that it just doesn't dig in, it doesn't have too many sharp corners or curves. And to be honest, I just wanted it to be a bit flash because it's the Holy Grail guitar show.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Yeah,
I was already nervous about it. So you want to take the best, put your best foot forward, really.
Who did you go for pickups wise in that guitar?
No, I didn't. I wound them myself.
Oh, did you? Oh, cool.
Yeah,
because you've used Oil City quite a lot in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have like a brand that you stick to, or do you just mix it up?
My two go-tos are, I used to use Lace quite a lot, but I haven't had many requests for them so much. So my go-tos tend to be, I use Oil City, and I use a guy called ERS, who's a Turkish pickup winder, and he does custom wound stuff. And he also does like the wood bobbins and things like that. So his pickups are stunning. They're just lovely, beautiful sounding pickups. And he does a really nice job doing like the wooden bobbins and things like that.
Which I guess is important because you really do try and, you know, bring that sort of wood look throughout your instruments.
Yeah. And I'm less attached to the whole wooden bobbins thing now myself, but it's still a nice looking thing. And, you know, we get custom orders where people ask for wooden bobbins and things like that because it looks quite SBC still.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I've just started, I've got a set of Lundgrens going on to a commission, which I'm really excited to hear because they're the M7s. So I'm really excited to plug them in and play them. And because I think Meshuggah used the M7s, but also, I forget his name, the guy from Mars Volta used them for a while as well.
Omar Rodriguez Lopez?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Did he? Wow, I did not know that.
Well, it says that on their website, but I could have misread that.
No. I'll admit there must be at least there must be a couple of things that I don't know about Omar Rodriguez Lopez, so maybe that's one of them.
I would say it's fairly plausible that somebody as exacting as himself has probably tried quite a few pickups. It's how generous you want to be with saying that they're a user or not. I don't know, but
yeah, exactly. That makes sense. Okay, well let's talk about the guitar that kind of started it all. I want to know about how you've ended up at this point, because certainly it feels, obviously we'll get onto that, but it feels like SBC are in a process of development or change at the moment. So I kind of want to hear about the first guitar. What got you started? What was the first model?
Depends how far you want to go back.
Well, I guess the first model maybe that started this range, because you in your series. Now, have you changed the names of the models now? So it's no longer the SB3, SB4, SB7, etc.
Yeah, so most of the original models we've sort of sidelined.
Right.
The SB3, SB7 is the only one that we're taking forward, and we've changed that to the Libra, because it's the whole premise around the SB7 is like the absolute perfect balance that you can get from an instrument. So,
and in the case of the SB7, it's a very small body shape.
We've upped it a little bit since. So the very original SB7s were tiny, and they were about 30 mil thick as well, and you could almost punch through them if you weren't careful.
Right, I see.
Yeah, and we've upped them a bit since, and particularly is that we've done a few more like extended range versions of them and things like that, so we've had to up them a bit. The first proper model was the SB3.
Which is kind of a modern telly. It's a single cut shape that's got a squarer body, so I'm using the closest instrument from convention for listeners who might be unfamiliar.
It was originally meant to be a telly. It was the very first guitar I built was this obnoxious, horrible thing that I designed when I was 16, and it was like if a BC Rich and a bar table mated and spawned.
I see.
Yeah, it wasn't where it came from is I had this, the first electric guitar that I had was this cheap, nasty Hamer Slammer that I absolutely love and still have today. And the first thing that I did with it, being the person that I am, it had a Floyd Rose on it. And the first thing I did with it is I completely dismantled it and looked at it in its assembled parts and then put it back together. And this is before having great internet signal or anything like that. I just put it back together as a 16-year-old on my bedroom floor and managed to put it back together with a new set of strings on it, and it worked fine. And, you know, I must have put it back together correctly. But
well done.
I'm sure the intonation was shocking. And that sort of started me off, really, because it was just looking at that guitar. And I like Superstrats. I've still got a couple and I've still got a lot of time for them. And it was looking at these Superstrats and thinking, this is cool. Why isn't this bit cut away here? Or why isn't it smaller? Why does an electric guitar have to weigh as much as it does when the fundamental sound comes from the strings and the pickup?
Right.
And that's all where it came from. And somewhere out of this, I designed this horrible BC Rich looking thing that was surprisingly comfortable to sit with and play. And then the next one from that was a telly, where I tried to use a router for the first time and made a horrible job of it and ended up cutting the body down the center and bolting a fence post in between it. And thus the first through body SBC guitar was born.
Great.
And great. From that, it was then the next guitar I built was the SB3. So it was only the third guitar I built was the SB3. And it was the first good guitar that I built. And it, in retrospect, it wasn't very good, but you know, it was very playable. It was comfortable. It was neck divey as anything, because the first SB3s before the one that you got, they were had an even shorter body. So like, I think the strap button was over like the 19th fret. So
it's over the 12th now. So it's quite functionally placed.
Yeah. Yeah. But as soon as you let go, it just hit the floor, you know?
Yeah.
But it was lightweight and it was really comfortable and it was thin and it was resonated well for a solid instrument. And that's kind of where it started from, really.
I see. But you're choosing not to take the SB3 through into the new line of guitars.
I will still do it to order, and I have still got that SB3, and I kind of decided to keep it because I like it, and it feels like the one that you had, because that was the sort of second generation SB3. It was a bit bigger, the balance was a bit nicer. It was still a little bit headstock heavy, but it was much nicer than the original SB3 design. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a really nice update of almost like a modern revision of a Tele with a smaller body, thinner, lighter, still really resonant, still got a lot of punch, and still ultimately a workhorse instrument, because that's kind of all I ever wanted to build. I know that I've kind of got away with that from that a little bit with some of the inlays and weird and wonderful things I've been doing, but ultimately I still just want to build instruments that people want to play.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that's, you know, that's very much something I've tried to keep sight of.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's especially when you're making things that are, you know, whilst I appreciate, obviously, as we've stated a million times on this, ergonomics are the centerfold of everything. They are very artistic instruments. And so I guess to it's a fine line to tread to keep that balance, to make sure you're always focusing on the usability and the playability of the instrument, along with, you know, putting all the sort of squiggly lines of Purple Heart through everything. but so I guess moving forward, you've the range moving forward is now going to have the Lyra and the Vega. Those are going to be the two core models moving forward in the guitar line of things.
I think probably the core models at the moment are the Cygnus. Well, the Cygnus is doing pretty well at the moment because we've sold, we've done a few commissions off the back of that since Holy Grail, which is nice. And then the Vega is also a very popular sort of eye-catching instrument. And then the Lyra is moving a little bit more towards doing something that's a little bit more classically shaped.
The Lyra's definitely exactly what I was going to say, definitely more traditional in its shape and more sort of, comparatively. And again, you know, it's always tricky when I don't have a body shape as reference for listeners who might not be familiar, but the Vega is, has a very oversized top horn in order, I guess, to level out with the 12th fret so that it sits in the right place, which is, you know, I guess the opposite way round from how you're used to looking at guitars. And then with a kind of a really extreme cutaway on sort of the lower bout that sits furthest away from you. So the guitar's angled in an unusual way and is very much its own shape. Whereas the Lyra is kind of, it's a bit more conventional, a bit more sort of moving into SG territory.
It's meant to be a sort of offset SG, essentially, right? Like a smaller, slightly smaller bodied, similar sort of, like, you know, fairly thin, but like essentially an offset SG, but with that, we call it the inside leg cutaway. Uh-huh. So that you still get that bit of ergonomic flair on it that just encourages you to sit it on. Well, it doesn't encourage, it kind of does encourage you to sit it on your inside leg.
I see.
The reason being is it is meant to be better for you. It's meant to be better for your posture. It's meant to be better for your playing position. Sort of gets you sitting upright a little bit more. But the other thing that's really cool about that inside leg cutaway is if you're playing live, you put your leg up on the PA system or whatever, you can put that guitar right on your other leg and look absolutely awesome doing it.
There you go. That's what it all comes down to, really. Whether you can, whether the guitar can stand on your leg when you're on a PA. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I'm into it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, the bass thing. Let's talk about the bass thing as well. Because recently, obviously, and I got to try out at the guitar show, you've made the Falcon bass. And certainly bass has always been kind of a core element of your Ranger guitars as well.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you got to play the very first bass that I built, actually.
Which was the short scale was like a...
Yeah.
Was it even 30-inch scale? Was it slightly less than that? It was 30-inch.
It's a 30-inch set neck bass. It had originally been a through neck bass, and I hadn't really liked the original through neck. I hadn't really liked the woods that I'd used, so I'd cut those off and turned it into a set neck, and we'd got this beautiful solid bit of sapele, ribbon sapele, and just set it in, and it worked really nicely, and it had that nice sort of thump that a short scale should have, I think, and just a nice response to it, and again really comfortable, really fun. And I always feel a little bit happy about it when I can say that actually that was an instrument that sold as well, and we sold from it. So it was obviously we were on the right sort of direction. Particularly, we don't sell stock guitars, so to actually sell a stock guitar is always quite exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's it's a confirmation that you're going down the right track with the model.
And I think as well with bassists, though, is that I've always found bassists to be a bit more open-minded about the ergonomics and about the shape. And that's not really quite the wording I'd like to use. I can't quite think of the wording. But I think the guitarists, there's a little bit more set in stone about what ergonomics and what shape a guitar should be. Whereas I don't think bassists quite had that history. And I think then you've had some great people like Warwick that have come in and have sort of redesigned it periodically and gone, well, why does a bass have to be just a bigger version of a guitar, and sort of played around with the ergonomics and the size and the shape and come up with some cool stuff. And I think they've set the groundwork really nicely for little people like me to come in much later on and go, oh well, this is cool, let's make it headless and fan fret and let's put in all these weird little cutaways and have some fun with it.
I guess you're absolutely right about that, about Warwick kind of being responsible for a big, you know, redefinition in what a bass was that maybe didn't quite happen so much in the guitar world, as everything, you know, even modern really kept on a sort of super strap format, whereas Warwick very much invented their own thing. So in the case of the Falcon, you've gone, so the one that I got to play and see, and I guess the first one that you made, which was a signature model, which was designed for Calvert Stevens.
That's right.
And so this was a headless, and was this your first headless build of a guitar or bass?
No, I think, well, it was my first headless bass. It wasn't my first headless build. I've done a few by that point, but not a huge amount. It's always something I've wanted to do, and it's always something I've wanted to do for stock, because you always get, like, particularly at guitar shows, you do tend to get a lot of sort of headless fans. And I like a headless. I like the feel of a headless, but I don't overly like a lot of headless instruments that are out there.
I see.
Because they're always... I'm not a big fan of the ones that are just like a super strat without a headstock, because it just... It sets me off. I go a bit twitchy.
Right.
And then it was Cal's idea to put a sort of mini headstock on it. And with the smaller body and then this slightly mini headstock on it with the headless on it, it just looked more balanced.
I see.
Like aesthetically, it looked right to me to have that on there. And
I think it's a really unique feature. You know, it's a really unique idea. It makes it look different from other headless guitars. Is there a reason behind this, the string ends being in different places at the head?
Yeah, with the fan fret, it's typically you sort of move the strings a little bit in.
Right.
So putting the retainers at a sort of staggered spacing means that there's no clash between them. And well, that was part of the why we ended up also doing the headless shape a little bit, because it just gave a little bit more room to play around with that and have a bit more fun with that without anything being too near the edge.
I see. Yeah, that makes loads of sense. And in this case, obviously, as we said, it's a six string fan fretted. Is the Falcon, is this body shape going to become, is this part of the standard line that will be moving forward?
Yeah, so the Falcon is specifically Cowell's signature instrument. The body shape is it's just a variant of the S-Bass 1, the original SBC guitar's bass.
I can see that. I think it's just that it's a six string. It makes it look so different.
Yeah, and because it was headless, we moved the shoulders in a little bit because it didn't need to worry about the balance so much, because headless don't tend to be so front heavy anyway. And, you know, we were able to sort of combine things down. With his one, there is so much electronics going on inside that bass that it makes my brain hurt to think about ever having to wire another one again. But, you know, hopefully as and when someone goes for one, they'll go for a simpler internals.
What was going on with that then? Because it's a pair of Bartolinis, right? So it's just 9 volt. It's not 18 or anything, is it?
No, it's 18 volt.
It is 18. Right?
Yeah, it's 18 volt. It's a pair. It's a Bartolini Singularity at the neck, and a quad core at the bridge, and then it's got the clean boost buffer in there,
right?
Which is it's not a huge amount of wiring in that, but then it also had a 3-band EQ with a stacked mid, and then we put in a 3-way switch on the quad so that it could be single, phase and out of phase.
Right, so I see.
There was a lot, and it's because it's a smaller body instrument, there was a lot to fit into that that lower cavity.
Yeah, without making it completely hollow, I can imagine it was.
I have literally done that on a bass before, because it is the problem. There's always that balance with doing a smaller body instrument and trying to fit in everything that a customer wants. And I had a commission bass before that, which was, again, it's another multi-scale 5-string. And I ended up doing the whole bottom of the body hollow to fit in, again, the ridiculous amount of electronics that customer wanted. He also then wanted disco lights in the top section. So I ended up making that hollow as well, so we could put the disco lights in and a built-in tuner into it, a built-in chromatic tuner. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Wow, that is a built-in tuner. That's not content to have it on his pedal board. I see.
No, I loved it though. It was so cool, and it was different. Fine. Yeah,
it's so ridiculous. It's brilliant. Yeah, I'm totally game. I'm totally into that.
Yeah.
What about you know, we're coming up to the end of this week's Friday special, but what about I guess, you know, what's next? Or do you have is there an exciting build that you're working on at the moment?
There's two really exciting commissions that I'm working on that I'd like to talk about a little bit. I'm working on a Cygnus signature model for a guy called Charlie Newbury, who's a solo artist, and he's another student at BIM as well, because I'm collecting them. And he and Cal are actually friends, so they've sort of he I don't know if you're aware, but Cal recorded a bunch of videos for me for my YouTube as like sort of official videos as part of my, as part of the sort of trade with him becoming a sort of signature artist, if you like. And he did one using some of my instruments with Charlie, and that was just so much fun to watch. It's called, I think it's called Sunday or Sunshine. Anyway, it's on my YouTube, and it's amazing bit of proggy sort of funk metal. And it's a lot of fun. And he got in touch with me, and I met up with him in Birmingham at the show, and he sat and played the Cygnus for 40 minutes and kind of fell in love with the shape and the feel of it, and approached me about doing a seven string. So I'm doing a seven string Cygnus for him with, it's fairly straightforward actually, but it's got a resin set top. So it's got, it's a little bit different. It's a, you've probably seen them about because there's a few people using them now, but it's by a guy called Tobias who does these resin burls where he injects resin into them and you get these crazy colors going through it. This one's maple and it's got this green going through it, and you know that's going to be part of his thing. It's got again, it's a headless, so it's got a similar sort of shape headstock to the one that we did for Cal, and that will be the sort of the noob headstock. And of course, for no real reason, it's got a velociraptor inlaid on the neck.
That's great. You never have to answer for a velociraptor. That's fine.
No, yeah. And a special thank you to Matt from Fidelity for helping me get that inlaid.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. The sort of the interrelationships of the UK guitar community. Everyone knows everyone.
It's a lovely community. As well, it is a really lovely, by and large, a really lovely community where people are generally pretty good and willing to help you out as long as you're decent and respectful. The other builds I've got on, I've got two more customs that I'm really keen about, and another two in the pipeline as well, which is awesome. The other custom that I'm really excited about is a variant on the Cygnus. And it's a double cut version of the Cygnus, and I think that's going to be a really exciting shape because we've never really done
that's almost going to be the most conventional thing. I'm into the idea. I'm into to seeing what you do with that top horn on the Cygnus model.
Yeah, I haven't put out much about it yet because I want to get it to a stage of either fairly complete or completely complete. The other thing that's kind of weird about this one is that it's a floating bridge, but it's still a multi-scale and it's a headless, so it's a whole host of new things in one.
Great, that's great. You've got to catch them all, I guess.
Yeah, and then the other thing that we're doing as well, which I'm not doing so much, I've delegated this, but we've got five new stock build basses on their way. So, you know, hopefully at some point we can start doing more like proper bass shows and getting a little bit more bass involved once we've got a bit more bass stock available, because at the moment we've only got one and it's a short scale left hander that no one's really ever been that keen on. So, sure. Yeah.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And that's definitely something that, you know, we'd love to, you know, to get hold of one of and try it out and talk about it on the podcast. Because as we've just recorded the pilot episode, as it were, of Bass Guitar Nerds, which will be a new show that we're running in addition to Guitar Nerds. I've got a whole new team of lovely hosts for that one, so I don't have to have any of the other lot on there. It would be great to review them and talk about them on that show when they're about and when Bass Guitar Nerds is about.
I saw you announce that today, and I have to say I'm very excited about that.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be good. Oh, Bass Guitar Nerds. I think when this episode airs, in fact, the pilot will just have come out. Yes, listener, yes, when you're the pilot will have aired a couple of days prior to this episode. So I hope you enjoyed it. As you know, if you haven't checked it out yet, we've got our two new hosts are Naomi McLeod and JD Short. JD Short was actually on our NAMM podcast back in 2018, but Naomi is new to the podcast. Both fantastic bass players, way better than me, and both have very much their own individual and unique style of bass. So I think I've actually, whereas, you know, the normal Guitar Nerds hosts are, you know, a bunch of sort of hurtling towards 40 guys obsessed with Telecasters, I've actually put together a team that represent the bass community a little bit better for this. So yeah, so Stuart, I will look forward to checking out your basses on the Bass Guitar Show. That would be great.
Yeah, well, I very much hope that I'll have at least one of them finished by the end of the year. So I'd absolutely, I've never been in a position where I've had so many custom commission orders.
Well, that's the place you want to be.
It's been fantastic. And I do have to say thank you to all those people for entrusting me to help them sort of fulfill their dream, really. But it's a lovely place to be, but it does mean that I've had to step back some of the stock. And in some ways, it's the stock stuff that I love doing, because that's where I get to...
You've got the freedom.
Yeah. I love how the custom commission stuff pushes me, but I love the stock stuff. I can take some of those ideas and run with them for a bit.
Slightly less stressful, I guess. You know, you can sort of see how something goes, and then if you're not liking it halfway through, you can change it. You know, whereas I think you're I guess more working towards an end goal with something for a customer.
Yeah, I mean, that, or you can cut a body out the wrong way round and have to change it anyway, so...
Sure, yes, yeah, yeah. I imagine that is the case. Well, that's about all the time we have for this week's episode of the Friday Special. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on, Stuart. Thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It has been great. And you can, of course, check out Stuart's incredible guitars at sbguitars.co.uk, or, you know, on Instagram. It is such a wonderful range of photos on there. So sbc_guitars on Instagram. Go and check those out. And you can, of course, catch more Guitar Nerds over on our Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds, or join us on any of the major social platforms with @guitar nerds. And we'll be back next week with our regular episode on Wednesday and another Friday special on Friday. We'll catch you then for more of this Guitar Nerd. Farewell.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.